That's the venerable Oscar Peterson on piano introducing the exquisite Ella Fitzgerald in a live performance in 1961 of Airmail Special. Two other big names complete the ensemble, Ray Brown on bass and Egg Thigpen on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and you might have noticed that since the year began, since our first program on air, that was just yesterday, I am trying to round out and reinforce the discussion that began last year on having greater clarity about our political situation. And in so doing, arriving at a point of reckoning, is the word that I've been using, about the system and where we are with it and where it is with us. Today I want to talk about fake politics. And in the context of propagating the dangerous myth that opposing Donald Trump is the same as opposing the system. And it's a sleight of hand, and of course we can't really swear that the world of politics is on the up and up. It just has never been the case. But we see a very interesting trend developing, and it has a purpose. Fake news, the gluten-free, lower-calorie term for what used to be called disinformation, lies, and propaganda, played a significant role, as you know, in shaping the attitudes and choices of millions of voters in the 2016 presidential election. Although fake news for a long time has been an integral part of the information, and I use that word advisedly, disseminated by mass media outlets, only recently has the widespread practice exposed a national menace and a threat to the long-standing principle of freedom of information. But fake news also has been exposed to be feeding an insidious sibling called fake politics. So we're going to talk today about the clear connection between fake news and the derailing of mass struggle in the United States. Why now? Why is this, after a little, at least going underground for a little while, outside of the glaring gaze of the media, fake news and fake politics have resurfaced with a virulence. Perhaps it is because the stakes are very much higher. Perhaps it's because there is a need to clamp down or to stifle movements, mass movements, before they gain any more traction. But in any event, we see that there is a connection. What is the point of fake news? What is the point of media anyway? It is about shaping people's attitudes, and in shaping attitudes, they shape actions. So we are all in one way or the other affected by media in this way. But then there is an underground program, and it's becoming more and more brazen, actually. It doesn't mind being known now. And that is to just be blatant about it. We are providing you, the public, this is the attitude of the fake news program. We are, in fact, providing you with, quote, alternative information, but understand that it comes loaded with an agenda which you may or may not know. It comes loaded with an agenda. And the agenda, the purpose of the fake news agenda, I should say, is to redirect your attention, to capture your mind, to basically condition you to accept things without question, and then ultimately to act on everything provided to you as information, unquote. You will swear on a stack of whatever holy book that you use, you would swear on a stack of them that you know what's going on. You have been informed. You are in touch with current events. You know the details of things. And yet, it doesn't dawn on most people that perhaps they're being played, they're being conned, they're being manipulated. And as is the tendency, this is the psychological underpinning for it, people in the fake news business know that it is not likely that people will check or double check what is being presented to them. They'll just inhale it. And it becomes part of their reservoir of information, which they draw from every single day. They are misdirected, they're misinformed, and increasingly, they also don't care. They don't care about it. Then we see how this conditioning translates into actions, because there has long been, it's been established that information informs your attitudes, your knowledge base, your interpretation of the world. And you are more likely than not to use this so-called information as the basis of your actions. And we saw that right in this recent presidential election, where we were just bombarded with crazy information that made the good people look bad and the bad people look great. a lot was invested in the dissemination of false information about the candidates, about their policies, about their histories, and so forth, in order to make them appeal to a constituency they had defined as necessary for their victories. I mean, people are still crying over Hillary Clinton's loss. They see her loss as a severe blow to America, because she would have been such a great candidate. She would have been a fantastic president. You know, she's got all these skills. There's nothing she couldn't accomplish if only she were elected. And so much on the other side was invested to derail her candidacy. So that's the role of information as we understand it to be now. More and more, this fake news giving us a distorted view of our reality, a distorted interpretation of what's real, and doing so deliberately to steer us in a predicted direction that is to the advantage of the people manufacturing the fake news. But now we see instances, and they're becoming more and more abundant, in which the fake news is also undergirding our popular understanding of politics and our individual roles in this thing, this process called the electoral process, and other things as well. Fake politics. If you get a hold of a newspaper or you check the news online, you'd see a story, for example, saying that several civil rights activists were arrested just yesterday during a sit-in at the office of Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, who is pegged by Donald Trump to be U.S. Attorney General. They sat in at the office because they object to his appointment or to his nomination and possible appointment, because he has a racist history. And so they wanted to bring that to the attention of the public. And as members of many civil rights organizations, this was going to be the best way to bring that point forward. And, of course, it was a way of saying that the opposition to Donald Trump has begun. Okay. It got quite a bit of coverage, as a matter of fact. And so the story, as of today, indicates, A, the struggle, the fight, the opposition to Donald Trump has begun. And this is perhaps the first coordinated effort at opposing him. Now, here's where the fake politics comes in. Now, I understand, you know, the value of coverage. I mean, over 40 years or so, I get it, how events like this should, you know, in the eyes of the people who are staging this, should garner some kind of coverage. They want to communicate a message, and they also want to be seen as being proactive. That's great. I understand that. But where we ought to be with stories like this is that we ought to understand also that this is, in a way, a strong effort to distract our attention from our political realities that we know so well. The groups involved are civil rights organizations with a long history of involvement in issues promoting equal rights and freedom and justice. So we can't question their motives there. But we can take a look at what they are actually saying without probably being aware of it. Or if they are aware of it, it is secondary to the publicity that they seek as being in the forefront of a so-called struggle. These are high-ranking officers of these civil rights organizations who were arrested. And what our thinking ought to be is that while we appreciate the symbolism of their participation in this protest, the sit-in, we also should pay attention to the fact that it is not actually a risk. It is not a penetrating struggle going on here. It is largely symbolic. And as people who understand that we are in a volatile period where we need to go beyond symbolism, we need to start asking questions here. Is it enough simply to sit in? And again, I appreciate the fact that they did make an effort and they did do this. But I'm also saying we should move beyond this. We should have moved beyond this by now. Sitting in at Jeff Sessions' office is a symbolic action. But I do note that we don't have backup here. We don't have a history by the same people who are involved in the sit-in of taking risk, the risk of leadership, which would involve being castigated. It would involve losing the perks that come with the office that they hold, enjoying a high profile, and of course, being known, just being known. These are very important things to people of this caliber. But to say that we are going to file a lawsuit, we're going to get into the trenches, that's not going to be them. We need all hands on deck. Don't get me wrong. Anything that helps achieve the greater goal is fine. But I'm saying here that we have an opportunity in the form of leadership to make a far more solid point. And that is about the structural issues. This is not about Sessions and the appointment of one person, and you happen to object to that one person, even if your reasons are valid. But I'm saying that this does not make the serious connection that we need to have people in leadership positions make, connecting the dots. This is not about one individual. It is about a system. And in the end, we have to see that when we weigh the facts of a situation just like this, it's small in the scheme of things, but it's very significant. Because this is the kind of politics that we have been subjected to for a very long time. Symbolism. In no way, even if they were successful at getting Trump to retract his nomination of Jeff Sessions, and that is highly unlikely, the point I'm making is it does not in any way change the structure, the system. It doesn't challenge the system. And we're finding a lot of this kind of reasoning popping up at this time as Trump is about to formally be our president of the United States. A lot of people are actually demonstrating what has been wrong for a long time in our communities. We have symbolic reaction, symbolic movements. And I just hope that we can get beyond that point. I really do, because this, in a way, is playing games with people who are desperate for leadership that would take on the issues and will understand systems. So if you're tackling a systemic problem with just symbolic gestures, then we have a right to ask, what use are you in the broad scheme of things? I think, just the same, that it was a good effort. I mean, they made a strong effort. But I also think they're falling short here. You are the leaders of civil rights organizations. You should be way beyond symbolic gestures. And you should be displaying a very strong understanding of how systems work. You're not affecting a system. You're not affecting the system by sitting in and saying, we don't like this guy, we want him out of here. When the focus should be, we don't like this system, and we're working on getting rid of it. This is the way we choose to get rid of it. But it's a purely symbolic gesture in the end. And it is done in order to get coverage, in order to be seen as ahead of the herd that will be expected to oppose Donald Trump. But it has nothing to do really about changing the system. I want to read you excerpts of a story titled Black Paul's Plan Trump Resistance. Now that's fake news right there. Black Paul's Plan Trump Resistance. And here's what the story says. After 8 years of the nation's first African-American president, black lawyers were in for an adjustment no matter who won the White House. But members of the Congressional Black Caucus say they're bracing for the worst in Donald Trump, fearing a presidency that could set minorities back decades. Leaders of the group told Politico, that's where the story appeared, have already begun discussing strategies to deal with Trump and any policies they believe would disenfranchise African Americans, from public school funding to low-income housing to voting restrictions. Though the president-elect's supporters call the alarm unwarranted, black lawmakers say Trump's campaign and his cabinet picks more than justify their concern. Quote, "The stakes are incredibly high, and our community is counting on us as the last line of defense between Donald Trump and the worst of what America could offer," Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York said. "This is not the normal incoming president," added Representative Emanuel Cleaver of Missouri. "We had no plan for George Bush. I think Charlie Rangel and John Conyers would tell you they didn't even have a plan for Richard Nixon. But this is not the norm." Incoming CBC Congressional Black Caucus Chairman Cedric Richmond of Louisiana is expected to outline his priorities for the new administration when he officially takes the reins of the caucus on Tuesday. That's yesterday. Some members suggested challenging Trump on his home turf, Twitter, while others advocated nonviolent protests reminiscent of the civil rights movement. Here's another interesting, skipping some of the paragraphs. Still, Trump's African-American supporters, such as South Carolina Republican Senator Tim Scott, say it's too early to judge what he'll do as president. Quote, "What I say to folks is, let's give Mr. Trump a chance. Let's gauge progress in his administration by what he does," unquote, Scott said on Face the Nation earlier this month. "My hope is that what we'll do over time is we'll see that progress has not been stymied under a Trump administration, but we'll see that it has prospered." Robert Johnson, the billionaire businessman who founded Black Entertainment Television and backed Hillary Clinton, has also preached the same open-minded message. Quote, "I think the Congressional Black Caucus members and African-American voters in general should see this as an opportunity to engage President-elect Trump and his administration." Johnson, who has spoken positively about Trump since meeting with him after the election, said in the interview. Going back to the Congressional Black Caucus, here's a quote. "We speak for vulnerable people. We speak for the disenfranchised, and we take that seriously. And those appointments seem to be tone deaf to sensitivity and to, I think, just plain common sense." Now, why is this troubling to me? We have people who are in leadership positions here who sound rather naive about the process and the system. Don't these quotes sound like anybody on the street could have said them? But what was particularly disturbing to me was the fact that one of these members of the Congressional Black Caucus actually said they had no plans. They had no plans even going back to the days of Richard Nixon. But they have plans suddenly now. And even so, the plans are to kind of give him some slack, this is Trump, and see where he'll go, and that will determine how they react. You know, it just jolted me. They actually admitted they as what Hakeem Jeffries had said. He noted that the African-American leadership, they're conscious of the fact that the African-American community all throughout the United States view or hold the view that the African-American leadership in Congress is the last line of defense. And yet we hear that they suddenly think this is not a normal president, and that they had no plans. The Congressional Black Caucus had no plans in terms of putting up some kind of defense going back all these years. And suddenly they're aware that they ought to have plans, but they haven't made them yet. You know, Donald Trump is being inaugurated on January the 20th. So this is exactly what I'm talking about. We have the fake news, because this is fake news. The headline itself is fake news. The Black Polls Plan Trump Resistance. What do you mean you're planning? The man is president. You're only now planning? And you're planning resistance? And this is something that people should take seriously? This is fake politics. This is fake politics. This is the politics of accommodation, the politics of cowardice. When people say that what was important all these years, now they actually are saying this. All these years, when you were supposed to be in the trenches fighting, you admit now that we had no plans. We had no plans to about how we will defend those people who are desperate for leadership and who view us. They said, you know, they look to us as the last line of defense, which means that the African-American community is looking at the Congressional Black Caucus with great hope that somehow they will attenuate the impact, the social, political, and economic impact that they've been suffering all these years. I'm going to quote another piece of the message that we get from Hakeem Jeffries. He says, "This is not the normal incoming president. We had no plan for George Bush. I think Charlie Rangel and John Conyers would tell you that they didn't even have a plan for Richard Nixon." That's how far back that this member of Congress recognizes that the Congressional Black Caucus was just a symbolic presence in Congress. Symbolic. Now, at the same time that Politico is reporting this as a development, a significant development, it is also saying it doesn't recognize a story here. The story isn't that they're planning resistance to Trump. The story should be that they had no plans going all the way back to Nixon. They had no cogent resistance going all the way back to the days of Nixon. And of course, they don't mention that they had any plans at all, including plans to resist Barack Obama. Because the records show that Barack Obama wasn't especially kind to the African-American community. But it is mind-boggling that somebody would say, somebody in a position of leadership and a member of this group that he actually acknowledges is looked to by desperate black folks looking for competent leadership, that they had no plans. So it depends on how you see news. This isn't real news because the thrust of this is, again, that people are getting ready to fight Donald Trump, the person. There's no intention here of fighting the system. And we are now being encouraged en masse to equate the two. That if you're fighting Donald Trump, you actually are fighting the system. And nothing could be further from the truth. Not at all. You see what I'm saying? So these are the things we have to keep in mind and look out for. And this is why each of us must come to a point of reckoning about the political system. They didn't have plans for Nixon. They didn't have plans for Bush. And we can agree that these were very lethal administrations. But they had no plans then. And the reason they had no plans then was because they would have had to take on an entrenched system. They have no interest in taking on a system. They don't have the guts to do it. They're not interested in any long, protracted struggle. They're there for 4 years and hopefully re-election, and that's it. How could you not have had some kind of resistance plan to Bush and even Nixon? My goodness. But now you're saying you're interested in putting together a plan, and it still isn't yet together. It still isn't yet known what this plan is. Although the man is about to be sworn in, you know, on January 20th. So we have to come to conclusions when we take these things into consideration as to whether this is a system, this Democratic Party and this current political system as it is, whether this is something that we need to be part of. They're telling you we are not doing our job, and we haven't been doing our job for a long time. And they expect to be returned to Congress to continue not doing the job. And we are concerned, we the people are concerned about their political futures and not the fact that they're not doing their job and haven't been for a long time. This is mind-boggling. And it says something about us and our state of mind, our inability to weigh the facts and come to a logical conclusion. This is not a party, therefore, especially if you're African American, this is not a party that you need to support. This is not the party for you. It cannot mount and it has not mounted a credible resistance, a credible opposition to a system. It won't do anything against the system. It will select instead to tackle personalities. Well, we don't like this guy. We don't like that woman. But they're not interested and they're not willing to take on any systemic fight. And yet, they stand in as the representatives of the African American community, and the African American community supports this, which is incomprehensible. This is fake politics. And of course, they're highly selective. They're not willing, and I can understand some of the reasoning for it. They're not willing to take on Obama. They haven't taken him on in 8 years. And yet we see all the systemic problems that he has caused and that he has maintained without change. Is it because he's African American that he is not to be criticized? He's not to be called on the carpet? Let me give you one example. And this is another report just reminding us that back in 2008, when Barack Obama was running for president, he received a memo from the president of a bank. The person was Michael Froman, and he was the chief executive at the time of Citigroup. He's now a U.S. trade representative, and he just sent an email. This was exposed by the WikiLeaks memos retrieved from John Podesta, who was Hillary Clinton's campaign director. Obama's running. He gets a memo titled Lists. And this memo titled Lists outlines a whole bunch of people that this Mr. Froman believed ought to be appointed to the Obama cabinet. Now, he himself was not a member of a cabinet, of the cabinet. He was not overtly in any way involved in politics. But he sends this Lists memo to President Obama. And wouldn't you know, just about everybody that he put on the list got on the cabinet. And they weren't especially spectacular at their jobs. As you remember, one of my favorite targets was the person who got to be the in charge of education, who himself had no great amount of educational credentials himself. But he was on the list. People like Janet Napolitano for Homeland Security, Robert Gates for Defense, Rahm Emanuel for Chief of Staff, Peter Orszag for the Office of Management and Budget, Arne Duncan, I just mentioned him, for education. And the list goes on for who should be in charge of the Treasury, who should be in charge of all these major cabinet-level positions. And Obama obeyed. Obama took the list and pretty much made it happen. Now, at the same time he's doing this, obeying the command of Mr. Froman of Citibank, or Citigroup, sorry, he has people who are supposed to be voting for him. He's not asking what they want. And you know, in many cases, these cabinet level members were disastrous in their jobs. Arnie Duncan was responsible for the closing of more schools than any administration. And almost all of them were in Black and Latino communities. And you have a Black president thinking this is okay. And you have the Congressional Black Caucus having no plans to criticize or to check against the president's plans. They had no objection. They had no objection at all to any of these people. So do we need any further information? If you just look at the past, you can see how systems prevail. That was the system. And not even the president, but president-elect of the United States and eventual president of the United States for not just one, but two terms, escaped criticism from the Congressional Black Caucus for the lethal effects his appointees have had on communities of color in the United States. The total or near total emptying of the city of Detroit. Lead poisoning in Flint, Michigan. All these thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are unemployed. And he escapes the scrutiny of the Congressional Black Caucus. It's fake politics. But we expect that from them. The question I'm raising is, what about us? What are we doing? And how are we holding accountable these systems, these wretched systems that are having such inordinately negative impact on our communities? Why are we still participating in systems like this? Pretending we don't understand or deliberately avoiding any kind of confrontation. We talk, but we are not interested in taking on even a small portion of the opposition to these kinds of systems and the things that they do, the harmful things that they do and have done. And nobody, no party is exempt. We have a lot of progressive movements, a lot of progressive parties that are party to this kind of thing. Whether by their silence or by their deliberate avoidance of dealing with systems. And don't be fooled. Again, opposition to Donald Trump is not opposition to the system. It's just opposition to Donald Trump. And we have to ask the question, how do we take on the task, or in what ways can we effectively oppose the system? Some people don't even recognize that it's a system. They talk about it in a hypothetical way, But they don't understand that these systems, or the system, is scientifically designed to achieve specific goals and objectives. Our fake politics, or our fake understanding of politics, allows us to ignore that fact. And we think of it in terms of, well, you know, Trump is a fascist. What the hell does that mean? And if you think he is a fascist, what are you doing about it? We have political movements that refuse to recognize it. We saw it with Bernie Sanders, absolutely refusing to call it as he saw it and as his followers saw it, his supporters saw it. They weren't confused. They were not confused at all about the system. But he was deliberately confused and deliberately ignored it. And we see, in the end, the fake politics that he was practicing allowed him in and his conscience to go join the Democratic Party and be its ambassador and to steer as many of the 13 million votes he got right back to the Democratic Party. And he still has not been punished for that. So we have to get serious, and we have to admit to ourselves exactly what is your political orientation. What would you stand for? What do you represent? What is your standard? Is this something that you're okay with? Have you separated yourself from this entire movement and discussion and just say, well, you know what? I can't do very much to change anything. They'll do whatever they want to do. But come, you know, the next election, I'm just going to try and vote for Party A or Party B because of all the parties, they're the least offensive. Is that where we are? And that's why I'm raising these questions, because we have taken the easy way out for a long time. We've been lying to ourselves for a long time. We have been misrepresenting ourselves for a long time when it comes to politics. We are, in fact, deeply enmeshed in fake politics. And we need to stop for a moment and take stock. This party or this movement that you're affiliated with, what does it believe? How has it performed with respect to an oppressive system? Other than the talk and other than the realization that we should have something else, that what we've got is not nearly enough. And it's not nearly in line with what we would consider to be a humane way of operating, a fair way of operating, a just way of operating. But we have also joined the fake political movement. And we are fixated instead on symbolism and on personality, as if that is a fix. It isn't a fix. So are we committed or not? Are we willing to take on some portion of responsibility for creating real and meaningful change or not? And we have to face these questions directly with ourselves. recognizing the state that we're in, and we know the truth, despite fake news. We know that all is not well in the United States, and it is terrible, downright terrible, for a large chunk of our neighbors and friends and families. There's a lot of suffering, and people are looking for insightful leadership and the creation of a different system or systems that would actually meet the needs of the desperate people. But we're playing fake politics and convincing ourselves that somehow we are involved in making change, in creating a better world. Wrong. Wrong. Thanks so much for joining me today. I appreciate it. And we'll be talking about these things. And now, we're doing it now, because we need to start the year off right as we began since last year, discussing things in a highly personal way about our vision, our definition of politics, the purpose of politics, and how we can create a new politics, a new direction, and whether we wish to still be a part of this grotesque mess, or whether we make some decisions that move us out of there, move us out of the morass, and gives us the room to begin to plan something else so that we can be meaningful in our political actions. Stay tuned. Coming up next is the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories@gmail.com. I thank you for giving me the room to just express these thoughts. And, of course, we'll follow up with a general discussion in which we share our thoughts about the issues raised here in these topics and programs. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow.